The following podcast contains some bad language. Don't blame us, blame Donald Trump.
Hello and welcome to The Europeans. I'm Dominic.
And I'm Katie. Hey, hey. Do you know why I'm saying that in Swedish?
No.
Because I've got a day off work today and I am building IKEA, which is, I think, the most European thing you can possibly do.
Yeah, well, it's definitely the most Swedish thing you could do.
No, but it's like a pan-European cultural experience.
But isn't it like an international experience? That they have IKEA in America, don't they?
I guess so.
Oh, Katie, you sound really sad that I've just stomped on your pan-European experience. I could hear just like a little bit of sadness in your voice and that's made me feel really bad. I'm sorry, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, you should feel really bad. It is a pan-European experience. Shut up.
Yes, it is.
You've just ruined my whole segue. I was going to segue into this whole thing about how this is a podcast about what it means to be European and how you and I are trying to explore that. But no.
Do that anyway.
It's too late now.
Oh.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm feeling a bit sad because I'm doing Veganuary and I hate it.
What have you been eating mostly?
Oh, just loads of like imitation cheese and milk. Imitation cheese is disgusting. Have you ever tried it?
No, for good reason, it sounds like.
It smells like feet, and not in the good way that some cheese smells like feet, but like in a way that makes you want to vomit.
Is it definitely just for January? Are you going to quit straight after?
Definitely just for January.
Let's move on from vegan cheese before you start crying. Should we tell everyone a bit about what we're doing here?
Yeah, so we are here to feed you with about half an hour of European ear sweeties. Vegan ear sweeties, of course. And your ears will need cleaning out with plastic-free cotton buds by the end of this.
Very cryptic.
Yeah, just wait. That will all become clear later.
Europe, we have a lot coming up for you this week. We are going to be talking shitholes and the trouble of translating Donald Trump with a man lucky enough to provide his voice on German television.
We'll be having a look at the plastic fantastic news that's coming out of Europe at the moment regarding plastics. I need to work on my puns.
And we're going to be talking French feminism with the writer Agnès Poirier, more than enough to keep Dominic's mind off his poor rumbling stomach. Shithole, Dominic.
What?
It's word of the week. Thanks to Donald Trump, who, of course, reportedly described Haiti, El Salvador, and some African countries as shitholes to a kind of general horror from everyone around the world. But what else is new there? Very racist moment, of course, from Donald Trump, and a very depressing moment. But if there is a tiny glimmer of light there, it's that it sparked this worldwide conversation on the internet about how to translate the word shithole, which was really, really fun. Did you see how it was translated in the Netherlands at all?
No, I didn't actually, but I assume they just wrote shithole because they're all so good at English.
Yeah, they probably did. There's been some quite fun debates about how to do it in France. We've mostly gone with pays de merde, which is literally shit country, which I think they did in Spain as well, with países de mierda. It does mean shit country, but I don't feel like it gets across the contempt towards those places in terms of them being like a crummy place to live kind of thing.
I agree. Hole is like less specific than country and more derogatory.
Yeah. Well, some countries went with a sort of toilet reference, which may be quite appropriate. Italy went for cesso, which is a rude word for toilet. And Bulgaria went for a word that means sewer, apparently. And Finland went for arsehole countries, which I thought was quite nice. Perslevmat. Yeah, but it kind of sparked this conversation about how to translate Trump. It's a really tricky thing. And while we were having fun discussing all of this on the internet, we fell into conversation, our podcast, with the guys behind another podcast, Troublesome Terps, which is a podcast for interpreters. They kindly put us in touch with Franz Kubicik, who is an interpreter who regularly is the voice of Trump on German television, and also Leonie Wagner, who's another German interpreter who struggled on occasion to translate Trump. They're both based in the lovely city of Cologne, and I gave them a ring. But you weren't there, were you, Dominic?
No, because actually I was rehearsing an opera by the other Wagner, not Leonie.
Nice.
Richard. And I was singing about England in German, because I'm rehearsing Tristan und Isolde, which is set in Cornwall, which we pronounce Cornwall.
Cornwall.
Which I think is ridiculous. Why can't we just say Cornwall?
I'll go back to our interpreters and ask them about that. But in the meantime, here's a really interesting chat I had with them about the very, very tricky business of translating Trump. You are quite often the voice of Donald Trump on German television, is that right?
That is right, yeah. Well, there are a couple of interpreters, depending on the TV station which has a need for interpreters. But I am one of those, let's say, lucky fellows who has to interpret Donald Trump quite frequently since the election and also before the election, basically the Democratic and Republican debates. So yes, that has been sort of a major focus of my work in the last 1 or 2 years.
Such an honor. So the three of us got talking on Twitter because, like quite a lot of journalists, I spent Friday not doing much work and mostly spending my time laughing about how different media were translating the word shithole. How has shithole been translated in Germany?
I think the most common one was Drecksloch, which is a beautiful word in German, and certainly not a bad translation whatsoever, but maybe not strong enough for how bad it is, how vulgar it is in English.
It's amazing that we're even talking like that in a podcast, but we have to actually cover that, even though it hurts as an interpreter, because you would never talk like that in regular working life, would you?
Yeah, I think the same is probably true for us as journalists. Although I think people are taking a certain amount of pleasure in having an excuse to, you know, just write email subject lines as just shithole. We have been having quite a lot of fun with it, although obviously that doesn't excuse the man from saying it.
You do have to laugh about it as long as you can, even though it's also very sad. It's sad, very sad.
Would you say that Trump is an unusually difficult president to translate?
He is, because he's so unexpected. Usually with politicians in particular, you have this sort of context. This is a politician on the diplomatic stage. So you have some sort of expectations of where they're going to go with their speech, because of their background, because of the situation they're in, because of the audience they're talking to. Trump just completely disregards any of that. Anything can happen. And if you heard him say shithole countries, if you were in that situation, there weren't any interpreters there, but if there had been, they would have probably thought, did he really just say that? And you don't have the opportunity when you're interpreting to just rewind and make sure that he really did say that. So you have to be very bold to decide for yourself, yes, he did really say shithole countries, and I'm going to have to translate that as truthfully as I can.
Live on television a lot of the time, which is one of the things that I think makes your job absolutely terrifying. I would never, ever want to do it.
Exactly.
I have heard many times it can't be that difficult to interpret Donald Trump because his terminology is rather basic, and that's absolutely true. He doesn't really use quite a sophisticated language. But what Leonie just said is something that I see as well in my work with that particular speaker. He can really get you off guard. It's that cringeworthiness, you know? Cringing is not something you can really do if you're doing live interpreting. It always gets to you like, did he really just say that? Okay, I have to say that. How can I say it? And those are all processes that are usually making interpreting much more difficult, and that horrible personality and the horrid things he's saying, they affect you as a private person as well, even though you have to be there as an interpreter and it's not about your private opinion on him. It still gets to you. It's quite a struggle. It's quite an internal struggle, because on the one hand, you think, oh God, what an idiot. I really hate this man. And on the other hand, you have to be that man and say what he just said without actually blinking. I'd say that's a rather special challenge.
We're used to hearing an interpreter's voice that is very neutral, you know, like no kind of emotion, just very smooth. What's it been like for you, Franz, being the voice of Donald Trump and having to keep that sort of very neutral tone? Have you struggled with that a bit sometimes?
I did, actually, because you have to somewhat get rid of that really neutral tone, because if he's anything, he's not neutral. So, I mean, if he's raging on and mumbling and raging and everything he does, and the interpreter sounds perfectly cool, balanced, fine, as if he were in a tea shop, I don't know, that doesn't really fit together. So you have to try to also be somewhat like him, as difficult as it is. And that is quite a challenge, because it actually shifts from mere interpreting to also acting.
From what I can understand, part of your job as interpreters is to make the person talking sound coherent in your language. what are you supposed to do with Trump, who, you know, if you were going to translate him faithfully, would sound kind of incoherent. If you try and smarten up what he's saying and make it sound a little bit more coherent, you're kind of giving him an unfair helping hand, you know, or maybe even misinterpreting his remarks to make him sound like he's coming across with a thought that he isn't.
That's exactly the point, Katie. I mean, everyone misspeaks once in a while. That's normal. So we as interpreters try to be as coherent as possible. And even if the speaker sometimes isn't, we try to sort of iron it out and make it like a little bit more presentable, because why not? Because it's the message that matters, not if someone slips up once in a while. When you have Trump speaking in front of the United Nations and saying Nambia. Is it Gambia? Is it Zambia?
Is it Narnia?
Exactly. You can't just go ahead and correct him, because that would give off a wrong impression. I think it's very important for people to know that he can't even name the proper African country that he's talking about.
They had an arms deal with Norway, and he bragged about the fact that they were selling these great F-52s, these fighting jets to Norway. And the thing is, there is no such thing as an F-52. It's a plane that is from a video game. It's from Call of Duty, but there's no such thing in real life as an F-52.
Oh, God.
Normally, you might think about correcting that. With Trump, definitely not. You have to let it be as it is, wrong, in order to show what an idiot and what a troll he is.
Just to finish off, I have a quick fire round for you. I'm going to give you some classic Trump phrases, and I would like you to translate them for me as quickly as possible, please. Leonie, you're going to go first. Big, beautiful wall.
Wunderschöne Riesenmauer.
Failing New York Times.
I'd go with Versager New York Times.
Yeah, that's really mean.
Crooked Hillary.
Ooh, Lügner Hillary.
Easy one for you, Franz. Huge.
Riesig.
Little Rocket Man.
Oh, der kleine Raketenmann.
Oh, that sounds quite sweet in German.
It does.
It sounds like a children's book. Der kleine Raketenmann.
Final one, Franz. Grab them by the pussy. How has that been translated in German?
Pack sie an die Muschi.
How bad does that sound in German?
It's 100% accurate in terms of the level of vulgarity involved.
Excellent. Good to know. Good news, European environmentalists. The EU is considering a new tax on plastic. For kind of obvious reasons, I guess. Firstly, we waste loads of plastic on this continent. You walk into supermarkets anywhere around Europe and you're going to just see things wrapped in plastic that don't need to be. And the other reason is we are about to have a big hole in the European budget after Brexit, like 12 to 15 billion euros a year that's just not going to be there anymore. And the European Commission has been trying to figure out ways that they might be able to plug that gap. And this is being mooted at the moment, a new plastic tax. What do you think about it, Dominic?
I think on the surface it sounds like a really good idea, because I don't like plastic and I myself try and buy things that aren't wrapped in plastic. Although the bananas that aren't wrapped in plastic in this country are actually not as good as the ones that are wrapped in plastic. And it makes me think maybe plastic is a really clever invention.
Bananas wrapped in plastic, that is mad. Like, bananas literally come in their own wrappers. It's insane.
I know. But why is it that the ones that aren't wrapped in plastic are so rubbish?
Because nature's rubbish, I guess. I think the Netherlands in particular is actually really bad for plastic. Like,
yeah, it's terrible.
Everything, you know, like you can get like individual carrots, I think, wrapped in plastic in some branches of Albert Heijn, which is mad. I think France is probably a little bit better for that. Like, most supermarkets you can go into and, you know, you can get most things loose and just weigh them yourselves, which is good.
Yeah.
But yeah, we don't really know much about what this tax would look like or even who would be taxed. It might be the producer of the plastic that gets taxed. It might be the customer who gets a little bit added onto the price there. It's really not clear how it would work or anything. It's just kind of like an idea that's out there at the moment. But I think it would probably be quite popular.
Yeah, it's one of those things that appeals to like such a broad spectrum of people. It gets support from the progressive environmentalists on the left and also these kind of conservative Daily Mail readers in the UK. The Daily Mail have been like claiming that they're at the forefront of like plastic prevention. Maybe this is an area where progress can actually be made, because it really needs to be made. That said, I wonder whether taxing plastics is the best solution for this environmental problem. Because in fact, there's quite a lot of research and invention going on around biodegradable plastics, which might be a much better solution. Biodegradable plastics could keep some of the greatness of plastics, the things we love about it, and not damage the little fishies.
Make plastic great again.
That's what we're saying.
Do you know how much waste the average European produces every year?
No.
480 kilograms.
480 kilograms is a lot per person.
A It's a lot. But within that, it was quite interesting. I've been on my new favourite website, Eurostat. Love it.
Oh yeah, I love it too.
There's a huge range between different countries. Who do you reckon is the most environmentally friendly country in Europe in terms of like producing the least waste per person?
Am I meant to pretend I haven't also looked at this?
Wait, you did make it sound like you didn't.
Did I?
Yeah, you were like, no, Eurostat.
No, I didn't say that. I was like, yeah, love it.
Okay, fine. Maybe you know the answer. Who is it then? Go and tell me.
It depends what you're talking about. I was talking about plastic bags, which is Luxembourg.
Oh, what? Luxembourg are the best or the worst?
Luxembourg are the best, along with Ireland and Austria, although those figures are a bit out of date.
Oh, I've got different stats from you. I've only got stats about like how much waste in general, including plastic, everyone produces. And that is really varied.
Go for it.
So at the bad end of the scale, we have Denmark, which is perhaps a surprising answer. I always think of Scandinavia as quite sort of eco-friendly, you know, producing wind and stuff like that. But producing wind, producing wind power and stuff like that. But
that is surprising because when it comes to plastic bags, Denmark were really good.
And also probably surprising, the least wasteful country is Poland with only 307 kilograms per person.
It is interesting because it's very different to the figures I got about plastic bags, which were that like almost all the Eastern European countries were by far the worst.
Oh, really?
And the Scandinavian countries were doing better, along with Austria and Ireland and Luxembourg.
I want to know what all the rest of that Scandi waste is then.
Yeah, me too.
Scandinavia, give us a call. Tell us what it is.
Well, one thing that I found out by doing this research was that actually the figures aren't very clear. There needs to be a bit more of a European-wide data collection scheme around plastics.
It's a very specific request. Make it happen, Jean-Claude Juncker.
Should be top of his priority list. The other story that I referred to in our introduction is that Scotland became one of the first countries to ban plastic-stemmed cotton buds in a move that people suggest will cut Scotland's marine plastic pollution in half. How can half of the plastic marine waste from Scotland be from earbuds? How much wax do they have?
Scots keep their ears famously clean.
Yeah, apparently.
What are you going to be able to make it out of instead? Like, can you make those sticks out of something else?
Paper. So, yeah, the problem is that apparently people flush their earbuds down the toilet.
What? Who does that?
Apparently Scottish people.
Oh my God, Scotland, sort it out.
And that's really bad because then the plastic goes into the ocean.
I'm sure this must be the case in every country. I don't think it's a purely Scottish thing. I just wonder why we're not having this debate everywhere else.
Yeah, well, maybe we will now. Maybe they're just leading the way. And
unless it is just the Scots that do weird things with their earbuds.
I wouldn't be surprised.
It's been a very big week for French feminism. Huge amount of argument going on this week, Dominic, after this letter that was written by Catherine Deneuve, the very famous actress, and 100 other French women, prominent French women, academics, writers, performers, that kind of thing, taking the Me Too movement to task for various different reasons and saying it's turned into a witch hunt. Men shouldn't be, you know, losing their jobs for things like touching a girl's knee or making an advance at work and that kind of thing. And it sparked a huge amount of debate in France this week.
I finally found a what I hope was a good translation of it. And it wasn't exactly what I thought it was. The papers have presented it as quite like a simple... They've just taken little aspects out of it and made it seem like it's all Catherine Deneuve, whereas actually she didn't write it. She just signed it, didn't she? I kind of think it's unsurprising that there would be this kind of reaction to Me Too. Me Too is a kind of revolution, and revolutions always have counter-revolutions. And revolutions should be self-critical.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of what is said in this letter is a bit misguided. And I agree that social media isn't the best place to have these discussions and that there will be some men who are falsely accused. But the big change needs to happen. The status quo needs to change. There are too many powerful white men in positions where they have been able to get away with abusing. And that is changing. And that is a good thing.
Yeah. And I kind of feel like, you know, this revolution, okay, social media has its limits. And it does turn into what one of Deneuve's supporters this week called a digital lynching. The tone of it gets very aggressive very quickly. But I also feel like this revolution couldn't have happened without the internet. You know, and this is something that is only possible in our age. And I think obviously it's something that's entirely necessary. This letter, yeah, I have a lot of problems with it. I should probably just come out and say like I'm pretty against everything that's said in it. But there is, you know, as we've mentioned, quite a bit bit more nuance to it than just saying these women want to apologize for rapists and stuff like that. It's really not that. So to discuss all of these things and more, we're going to call the French writer Agnès Poirier. She's written for lots of different media on both sides of the channel, so she's kind of very good at explaining France to the Anglophone world and vice versa. She is in a cafe right now. Her boiler is broken, so we apologize for any noise, but let's give her a call. I think if I'm following your tweets right, you kind of feel like the whole debate has been mischaracterized a bit in the English language press. Would that be fair to say?
There are great sentences and great arguments in it, and there are also some pretty bad ideas, like the right to pester. Apparently, men have the right to pester women. So, of course, no. But I think it's down to clumsiness, and that's a shame, because there are good things in this letter. And, well, their main point was to say, hang on a minute, the Me Too movement is fantastic, but now let's be careful about how we go about finding solutions to tackle sexual harassment. We don't want censorship in the creative industries and in art, because you are aware of it. Some films have been reshot. The Ridley Scott film, they edited out Kevin Spacey out of the film. That's pretty strange. It reeks of Stalinism. So I think their main point really was saying, be careful, let's not create a new moral order.
As you say, there's been a lot of different arguments mixed up in this letter. And the one that you mentioned, the right to pester, basically this idea that men should be free to flirt with women, whether it's welcome or not, has been seen from abroad as quite a French thing. And I just wondered what you make of that.
Well, I think, you know, it's quite unfortunate that they use the word importuné, which is the right to pester, because obviously there is no such right. However, probably what they wanted to say is that flirt is no crime. And that is true. And in France, there is, unlike in the US, where it's been the feeling of Simone de Beauvoir, first time she set foot in America in the late 40s, that there's this invisible glass wall between men and women, that there's this hostility, which doesn't exist in France. It doesn't mean that sexism doesn't exist in France. Of course it does. But there is a kind of harmony between the sexes that I didn't find in the UK when I first arrived in my early 20s, which I still don't find in the US. Also, French feminism has always been more moderate, perhaps too accepting of males' whims. But compared to the American feminism, which is much harder, if you'd like.
You mean American and British feminists are a lot less tolerant of flirting, basically?
Yes, I think so. And also sensuality is something that is not as easily dealt with.
So the hashtag Me Too, in France, you've used hashtag balance ton porc, or expose your pigs, which to me sounds kind of more blunt and more of a kind of hard feminist statement than Me Too, which is kind of the friendlier version. Do you think that's got something to do with why it upset these 100 women?
Absolutely. It's a most unsavory way of translating Me Too. And you know what? It's a French woman who is based in the US who came up with that balance d'emploi, which is, you know, call out your pig. It's, you know, something that is doesn't have the neutrality of Me Too and reeks of, you know, denouncing and you just throw men to the lions. I think a lot of people in France found it shocking.
But there have been obviously a lot of women taking to the internet, coming out with these stories of being harassed, of being assaulted under this hashtag. I think one thing that has been different in France is that we haven't seen as many high profile figures seeing their reputation kind of tarnished in all this in France. And I just wondered why that is.
You could say that up to the Dominique Strauss-Kahn scandal, there was a tolerance in France, and I don't think a very good tolerance, towards male chauvinism and sexual harassment in the name of courtship or flirt, and which obviously was not flirt, but simply abuse of power from elderly men, let's say. That, I think, changed a little. There was a shift after the Dominique Strauss-Kahn's affair or scandal. But I think you're spot on. There is more of a tolerance towards what some people would consider banter or playful frolicking But French society is changing, and the storm within France due to that letter, the fact that many new feminists in France bore all the content of that letter means that, you know, the debate is extremely heated, and in many ways it's extremely healthy as well.
Obviously, Catherine Deneuve is a privileged, beautiful, wealthy white woman, and that has meant that she's been criticised for making these statements saying that, well, she's not in a position to know what it's like to be harassed, which I think is unfair, but also it made me wonder whether it was actually helpful having her as a signatory. Obviously, it got attention for the letter, but do you think perhaps the letter would have been less criticised if it hadn't had someone like her, this glamorous actor, as the figurehead?
Yeah, I completely agree. And in a way, she's very brave, because considering the flak she took and the fact that she's rich, privileged, and had a flamboyant love life and a fantastic career, and she's a very intelligent woman, has nothing to do with her right to speak or not. I find it racist, really, to say that she has no say in the question because she's a white 70-year-old privileged woman.
Having said that, I do kind of feel like there is a divide here. Most of the women that signed this list were slightly older, obviously from like professional careers, because they're all prominent women. They were pretty much exclusively white. And I'm sure obviously you've seen the second open letter that came out, written by about 30 feminist activists in a kind of riposteless letter saying, you know, that this is rubbish. And that group were like mostly younger, very mixed race, came from lots of different backgrounds. There is something of a split here, you know, and especially because there's been a lot of criticism from feminists of that kind of group saying this letter really exposed the kind of privileges that these women have. They say, oh, you shouldn't feel like endlessly traumatized just because somebody rubs up against you on the metro. And there have been people saying, well, you know, when was the last time you took the metro, Catherine Deneuve?
I mean, the thing is, I don't think we should pit them against each other. I think, you know, feminism as a whole doesn't win by those constant bickering. You know, we all, I think, agree on the main thing is that we want progress. We want pay equality, for instance, which is, I think, the most important thing. What is important is the arguments they are making. I couldn't care less if they are, you know, the color of their skin or their age, as far as I'm concerned.
So, would you like a Brit Award, Katie?
Always. Wait, what do you mean?
You can get one now if you've got a bit of spare cash.
Can I?
Yeah, because Paul, do you remember Paul from S Club?
S Club 7.
7, yeah, but S Club for short.
Which one was Paul?
He was the one with brown hair.
Yeah.
I think he was the one that didn't really sing. Well, he has put his Brit Award up on eBay. The starting bids were at £600, but at the time of recording, bidding has reached 66,000 and is expected to go quite a lot higher.
£66,000 for the Brit Award of someone that was in S Club 7?
Yeah. So it's listed as in a very good condition, but he's very honest about it and says that it hasn't been professionally polished. And he says that he's got bills to pay, so that's why he's doing it.
Oh, that's really depressing.
It's kind of depressing, but also kind of good news because his bills are going to be paid.
Can I just say, I think the real scandal in all of this is the fact that S Club 7, no offence, were actually awarded a Brit Award in the first place.
Yeah, I agree.
What was it for?
I don't know.
Wait, let me check. Brit Award, S Club 7. Oh my God, they got loads.
Did they?
Best British single for Don't Stop Moving.
Good song.
Okay, so they won Best British Single, Best Pop Act twice. Oh, sorry, three times. They won Best Pop Act 3 years in a row from 2000 to 2002. That's amazing.
I actually had another happy news story, also from the UK, I'm afraid, but from Bristol Zoo, where they are celebrating the first time that a Lord Howe stick insect has laid eggs outside of their native Australia.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. It was disgusting looking.
So it doesn't look anything like the stick insects that were popular when I was growing up in the UK in the 90s.
What do you mean popular?
Was it just a North London thing? Because, like, all my friends had stick insects for a while.
What? As pets?
Yeah.
Okay, that did not happen where I grew up.
Anyway, these stick insects are really quite big and they can weigh up to 25 grams and are therefore nicknamed tree lobsters, which is actually a more accurate description, I would say. So they've been categorised as critically endangered, but it's a really big deal that they've managed to hatch eggs outside of Australia. And it's also a nice turn of events, because they were thought to have been driven to extinction after black rats invaded their habitat from a British supply ship that was stranded in 1918.
Oh, so it's the Brits' fault as well.
Exactly. It feels nice that a British zoo is now trying to help out after our nasty British rats caused all that destruction. So that's it for this week. Thank you for listening to our, it's only our sixth ever episode. Can you believe that, Katie?
Time really, really flies when you're having fun.
No, I was saying the opposite, that like, I feel like we've done a million.
Oh, you feel like you've been here forever?
Yeah.
Great.
But a big thank you to our guests this week, Agnès Poirier. She wrote a really nice article in The Observer this weekend, which you can find online, about the Me Too backlash and an insider's guide to French feminism.
And I think she's got a piece out in the New York Times as well, so do check that out. Thank you as well to our lovely German interpreters, Franz Kubicik and Leonie Wagner.
Make sure you follow us on Twitter, at EuropeansPod. We have quite a following that's... There are fewer and fewer sex bots. They seem to have gone off us lately, so we're feeling a little bit underloved. Please help fill that void.
Next week we will be heading over to the Swiss mountains to see what Trump again is getting up to at Davos.
I'm actually going to the Austrian mountains next weekend. Am I going to the wrong place?
Yeah, shit, did you not get the memo?
No, fuck.
The podcast anyway is going to Davos to check out what Trump is getting up to over there.
And I'm going skiing for the first time in my life, so I might be dead.
You've had your lessons, you're going to be fine.
Hashtag pray for Dominic.
We will see all of you next week, Dominic included, maybe on crutches.
Have a good week. Bye. We're testing out my new pop shield, and also Katie forgot to ask the Germans for a tongue twister, so you're stuck with me. Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers. A peck of pickled peppers Peter Piper picked. If Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers, I can't do this at all.
We should get the professionals back in.